In the first part of the lecture, I mentioned that there are two camps in the Islamic world. One camp opposes democracy and thinks that democracy is inherently incompatible with Islam, and we reviewed their arguments. And in the second part of the lecture, I'm going to talk about the modernist intellectual Muslims who do embrace democracy as a suitable form of government for Muslims. So we're going to consider their ideas. Modernist Muslim intellectuals are both in the Shi'i as well as the Sunni camps in Islam. So they are in both branches. They believe that Muslims can and should adopt democratic political institutions, and from their perspective, adoption of democracy is based on principle, not compromise or expediency. And this is a very critical point. These intellectuals ask a simple question to start their discourse. And the question is the following: did the political system of caliphate or khilafat originate from the Quran and the teachings of the Prophet? So that is the starting point. The answer, as I mentioned before, is no. It didn't really, has no basis in the Holy Quran or the tradition of the Prophet. It was really a product of Muslim experiences with the state and governance of an empire. Original Islam did not envision a system of government that had a fixed set of institutions and laws that must be established by Muslims across space and time. Because once you say we have the notion of Islamic state, it means that form of government is binding on all Muslims in all periods of history, in all societies. And these intellectuals obviously don't subscribe to that. They believe that neither the Quran nor the tradition of the Prophet Muhammad propose a comprehensive system of government. And for some Muslims, this position is a tough pill to swallow. The caliphate system that was adopted by early Muslims was simply a civic institution, not a religious institution. It was not founded by Islam, and there is absolutely no reference to caliphate as an authentic Islamic state anywhere in the Holy Quran. Islam does not have an official form of government. The reason these intellectuals make such a dramatic statement that you can adopt democracy as Muslims is that Islam does not have an official form of government. These folks argue that Islam has clear commandments and teachings regarding daily prayers or salat, for example, clear commandments with regard to ablution or wudu, clear commandments about fasting, pilgrimage or hajj, clear directives about the conception of God and ethics. Yet when it comes to the issue of state, there are no clear commandments or directives in the Holy Quran. This, perhaps, can explain why there is not a universally accepted political doctrine in the Islamic world, because we do not have any clear commandments or directives in the source of Islam, which is the Holy Quran. That's why Muslims don't have a political doctrine that they all agree on. Yes, it is true that the Prophet Muhammad ruled over the Muslim community in Arabia. However, he organized the community in line with the customs, traditions, and norms of his era. In other words, his form of government reflected what was the norms back then. Because he adopted those norms does not mean that those norms have religious basis. When the Prophet wanted to rule in the capacity of a political leader, what did he do? Well, he sought the consent of the people. In Arabic, what is the term for that? Bay'ah, right? Bay'at, which literally means consent of the people. This is very critical. He was the messenger of God. Yet when he wanted to rule, he had to ask permission of the people to do that. Which means that the prophet's government was based on people's vote, not revelation. He didn't seek legitimacy for his government by pointing to his status as the prophet. If that were the case, he didn't need to seek bay'at from the people or receive the consent of the people. Because when it came to intrinsically religious matters, such as daily prayers, ethics, conception of God, so on and so forth, he never consulted with the people. He never asked for permission from people. But when it came to the matters of politics, state, and government, he did refer to the vote of the people. In a word, what they are trying to say is the following, which is a very critical statement. Government is a civic institution, distinct and separate from religion. No doubt, Muslims can and should form a government to administer their public affairs. No society can function without a government. However, the act of forming a government is purely a rational endeavor. It has no basis in religion. Muslims should adopt whichever form of government that is proven by human experience to be the most just, the most efficient, and most equitable in their contemporary era. Whatever works, which serves Islamic values in the social dimension, that is the form of government Muslims should adopt, because Islam does not have a homegrown form of government. Politics in Islam has religious significance. This doesn't mean that politics is religious, but in Islam, politics has religious significance. Again, the fact that politics has religious significance in Islam does not mean that politics is religious by nature. Politics has been and will always be a civic and secular matter. Even during the time of the Prophet, politics was secular. I guess that's where a lot of misconceptions show up in the Muslim community. They think that because Prophet Muhammad formed a government, by virtue of him being a prophet, his government was also a religious government. In my opinion, that's a bad misunderstanding. A religion such as Islam may encourage or even mandate that its followers participate in politics. And when they do and form a government, that government will be a Muslim's government, not an Islamic government. Muslims have formed governments, but not Islamic governments. We call those Muslims' governments, which means the form and content of the government can change across space and time. But if it were Islamic government, the form and content and its laws must remain the same across space and time, and that is not true. So we should never confuse the notion of Muslims' government with Islamic government. And let me add something to this statement. The concept of a Muslim government is both meaningful and real. The concept of an Islamic government is meaningless and a misunderstanding of Islam and government. It's just sheer misunderstanding. Today, Muslim reformers and modernists argue that parliamentary democracy and republicanism is the best form of government that can safeguard Islamic values such as social justice, egalitarianism, and the rule of law. And these are all Islamically sanctioned values. So, these reformers are hard at work providing an Islamic rationale, an Islamic justification for democracy. And that is their grand project in the Islamic world today. And I'm happy to be one of them. Now, these intellectuals obviously make a case for adoption of democracy by Muslims. Now, are they just making it up? Or is this case firmly rooted in the Islamic tradition? So, for the rest of the hour tonight, I'm going to talk about the Islamic justifications for adoption of democracy. I'm going to discuss 5 or 6 bullet items to make the case for democracy. Number one, unity of God, or Tawheed, negates political absolutism and tyranny. Let me repeat. Those who believe in the concept of one God have to negate political absolutism and tyranny, according to these intellectuals. Why? Well, in the Holy Quran, Allah, or God, is described by using many attributes and descriptions. One of the descriptions of God in the Quran is Rabbun Nas. Rabbun Nas. Rab in English should be translated as sustainer and ruler. Sustainer and ruler. Nas means the people. Right? So in this context, God is the sustainer and a ruler over mankind. Who is a sustainer? Well, your sustainer is the one who controls your destiny and your livelihood. For Muslims, there is a social dimension to the unity of God, which involves viewing God not only as the creator, but also as sustainer and as the absolute ruler over mankind in their daily lives. Let me explain a little bit. What do I mean by being both a creator as well as a sustainer? Well, historically, I submit to you that there has been very little argument or very little disagreement as to whether our vast universe had a creator or not. Even today, in 21st century, most people in the U.S., which is the height of human progress and scientific and rational achievement to this point in the history of humankind, right? Most people in the U.S. do believe in God. A very small minority would question that this universe has a creator. So what is all the fuss about? Well, you can believe in God as the creator, but not necessarily believe in God as sustainer and ruler over mankind. And that's where the problem comes into the picture. In Quran's symbolism, the pharaohs, or Pharaon, represents a man who believes in God as creator, but aspires to compete with God as sustainer and absolute ruler over mankind. Pharaoh did believe in God as creator. He did not believe in God as sustainer and ruler of the humankind. According to the Holy Quran, Pharaoh addressed the Egyptians by claiming, "Ana rabbikum al-a'la." Ana rabbikum al-a'la, meaning I am your greater sustainer and ruler. The very same person who believed in God believed that he was the sustainer and the absolute ruler over the Egyptians. Note that here in the verse, Pharaoh refers to himself as Rab. Ana rabbikum al-a'la. Well, Rab or sustainer is a description that is exclusively reserved for God Almighty. No one else should ever claim to be Rab of people. Obviously, the Pharaoh did not believe that he was the creator of the Egyptian people. He knew that before he arrived on the scene, there were a lot of Egyptians who used to live in the land. What he meant was that he was the absolute ruler over them. In other words, he didn't need their consent. to rule. He did not need their advice as to how to rule. He could pretty much do whatever he deemed as fit. He thought that just as he had a herd with thousands of sheep, he also had a society composed of thousands of people. Just as the sheep didn't have much to say about their destiny, Pharaoh's subjects in society didn't have much to say about their destiny. That was the Pharaoh's conception of being the sustainer and ruler over the Egyptians. Now, it is precisely due to this claim that the Quran refers to Pharaoh as Taghut. How do we translate Taghut into English? Arrogance. Pharaoh was arrogant. Arrogant is one who rebels against God and His divine rule. Now, here is the point. In Islamic theology, Taghut or arrogance is any tyrannical character that imposes his will over an unwilling nation. Even if the person prays five times a day, if he rules without consent of the people, he can be construed as taghut or arrogant. If I were to use the philosophical language to describe taghut in English and in modern political thought, taghut or arrogance refers to the tendency of political power to concentrate and become absolute. Whenever you have this situation, an arrogance or taghut has formed. Now, taghut or arrogance tends to evade accountability. It tends to disallow criticism and dissent. Now, such a political system would resemble Quranic notion of taghut or arrogance. Now, in political philosophy, we call this system of government dictatorship or tyranny. The competing system to tyranny is what? Democracy. So democracy is a system that basically negates absolute power and tyranny. And if you recall from the earlier part of the lecture, democracy invites us to question power and authority, and it invites us to distribute power. So that's what democracy, in essence, is all about. Muslim intellectuals argue that democracy can serve one of the fundamental social values of Islam, namely opposing the formation of taghut and arrogance. Therefore, democratization of society and the state will act as a deterrence to the formation of pharaohs and tyrants in society. So definitely on this ground, Muslims can adopt democratic political institutions. Second important consideration for making a case for democracy: recognition of Muslims' right to challenge their rulers. This recognition is part of the Islamic tradition. And let me explain. Before I do that, let me reiterate one of the important principles in democracy. You see, democracy is often misunderstood, even in the West, as the government of people. Well, in reality, we know that people do not rule in the White House or in the Senate. I don't work as a systems engineer in the morning and then go enact laws in the afternoon. So in that sense, really, we have to take the notion of democracy as the government of the people with a grain of salt. What democracy is, really, it's a form of government that espouses control of government by the people. So government is controlled by the people. Not necessarily that the people actually sit in the White House or the Senate. Why do I say that? Well, the reason I brought this point up is that democracy empowers people to effectively control government, to effectively question political authorities, to criticize their policies and behavior. Now, this principle of democracy is definitely compatible with the political tradition of the early Islamic community. They are absolutely compatible. And let me explain a little bit. I'm going to give you a couple of examples. Abu Hamid Muhammad al-Ghazali was one of the most famous Muslim scholars and Sufis who ever lived. He had a famous book called The Alchemy of Happiness, or Kimiya-i Saadat. In that famous book, al-Ghazali narrates the story of the second caliph, Omar. When he was ruling over the Muslim community, Omar one night walked around the capital, Medina, to see firsthand how the capital was functioning. As he was passing by in a neighborhood, he passed by a house and heard the sound of music and singing. He was very curious who might be brave enough to dare throw such a loud party in the seat of Muslim power. According to al-Ghazali, he got carried away a little bit, so he crawled up the wall, went to the roof, and came down from the stairs into the house. And he noticed that a man and a woman were drinking wine, being very happy, and singing. With no introduction, Omar told the man, "Oh, you, the enemy of God, you really thought God would disregard such grave sins you're committing?" The man replied, "O ruler of the faithful, do not rush to judgment. If I committed one sin, drinking, you committed three sins." Now remember, he's the guy who was drinking, challenging the ruler of the Muslim community. "If I committed one sin, you committed three sins." First, in the Holy Quran, even though he was drunk, he could recite the verses of the Quran, according to al-Ghazali. In chapter 49, verse 12, God instructs, "La tajassasu," do not spy on each other, and you have spied on us. Second, in chapter 2, verse 189, God instructs, "Enter houses through the main doors, and you entered my house from the roof." Third, in chapter 24, verse 27, God instructs, "O believers, do not enter other people's houses until you have asked permission to do so and greeted them inside. And you entered without asking for permission and did not greet us." Well, Omar obviously was in a tough bind, huh? So Omar said, "If I forgive you, will you repent?" And the man agreed. So they were both happy. Now, al-Ghazali obviously is trying to make a very important point here. Even though the man was at fault, he did not feel intimidated to speak his mind against the ruler. He was not afraid of identifying and indicating the wrongs that the ruler had committed. He was not afraid. And the question is, why? I mean, can you imagine somebody in most Islamic countries today would say such things to a ruler? Impossible. Now the question is, why is it that this guy, even though he was at fault, was so daring to criticize the ruler? Well, the reason is that early Muslims were taught by the Prophet that unconditional submission is only and only worthy of God. Yes, Islam means submission. Not to political authorities, not to religious authorities, only to God. So, unfortunately, contemporary Muslims don't get it. Early Muslims fully understood that. That's why they were not intimidated by their rulers. No one in those days, in any position of authority, could treat people as though they were his subjects. And again, contrary to Muslims of latter generations who were brought up in an environment of submission to religious and political authorities, early Muslims definitely enjoyed a spirit of critique and questionings. And that's what we lack in the Muslim world today. The second example I want to bring you has to do with a sermon by Imam Ali, the second caliph, in his famous book, Nahj al-Balagha, or Height of Eloquence. In sermon number 216 in Nahj al-Balagha, Imam Ali invites Muslim citizenry to criticize his policies and government. He doesn't just say, "I allow you to do that." He says, "I encourage you to do that." Let me read you a passage from that sermon. Imam Ali says, "Do not praise me for carrying out my duties to God, my Creator, and to you who elected me to this position. Do not talk to me the way you would talk to tyrants. Do not hide the truth from me the way you would from those who cannot bear the truth. Do not treat me with the same protocol as you would treat tyrants. Do not be hypocritical or flattery in your dealings with me. Do not exaggerate in your words and deeds. Do not think that it is hard for me to be confronted with the truth. For one who cannot bear hearing the truth would have a much harder time acting upon the truth. Therefore, I urge you to be straightforward with me. Help me with your counsel and advices, since I am not immune from making mistakes. I wish Muslim rulers today would act 50% of what Imam Ali has said in this eloquent sermon." We can now clearly see that early Muslim rulers never viewed political power as sacred. They never viewed political power as being beyond critique or criticism. Sanctification of political and religious authorities was an unfortunate innovation that emerged a couple of centuries later in the Muslim community. This false innovation, unfortunately, contradicts the tradition of the Prophet and his close companions. Therefore, contrary to the views of authoritarian ideologues in the Islamic world, democracy is compatible with Islam precisely because it empowers people to speak out against political authorities. It empowers people to criticize government policies and not be charged with offending sanctities of Islam, not be charged with subverting the state, or as it is called today, threatening national security. See, these days it is very easy for politicians and rulers to seek to the concept of subverting the state or weakening the unity of the nation or threatening national security to crush dissent. In early Islamic era, this was not the case. They would allow, ordinary citizens to speak their mind. So, on this ground then, democracy definitely serves one of the fundamental principles of governance in the Islamic political tradition. Third, we have the concept of consultation or shura as a pillar of community in the Holy Quran, right? The concept of consultation or shura. On several occasions in the Holy Quran, it is stressed that consultation should be the basis of shaping public policy. It should be the basis and an integral part of the decision-making process. In chapter 42, verse 38, God says, Amruhum shura bainahum. Conduct your affairs by mutual consultation. So it is a commandment, a directive to Muslims to conduct their affairs with mutual consultation. What does consultation presuppose? Obviously, you have to make an assumption before you advise people to consult with each other. What is this assumption? The assumption is that no one person has all the answers. No one person knows it all. That's why you consult with each other. Now, this principle of consultation is so critical that God instructs the Prophet Muhammad himself to consult with ordinary people, not just the elite, with ordinary people when making decisions that involve their lives. Chapter 3, verse 159. Now, this is a directive to Prophet Muhammad. وَشَاوِرَهُمْ فِي الْأَمْرِ. Consult with them about matters. In other words, God is asking the Prophet to consult with the people about matters, social and political matters. The context for the revelation of this verse is quite fascinating. This verse was revealed at the time when the pagans had massed an army and they were about to attack Muslims in the city of Medina. The Prophet and his companions received word of an impending pagan attack. So the Prophet called for a meeting to decide how to prepare for the defense of the city and how to repel the attack of the pagans. Now, according to historians, the Prophet personally believed that Muslim warriors had a better chance of success if they stayed within the city of Medina and let the pagan army attack them in the city, because the city would offer a natural defense, right, the walls of the city, and the Muslims could make better use of the home turf advantage, as we call it today. Well, that was the opinion of the Prophet. Now, some folks in that meeting disagreed with the Prophet. They argued that it would be better if the Muslim warriors met the pagan army in the hills outside Medina. After long discussions, the majority of folks who believed they should fight in the hills prevailed. The Prophet and those who took his position, they lost. Those of you who've read Islamic history, you know what happened. In a place called Uhud, finally Muslims were beaten by the pagan army. Now, what would be the God's reaction to this event? The Prophet consulted with Muslims. Muslims made a decision, and it happened to be the wrong decision. So what is the natural reaction? Consultation may not be a good thing after all. So that is the natural reaction. Well, after the defeat of the Muslims in that war, that verse was revealed to Prophet Muhammad, indicating that despite the fact that you had a meeting, you counseled, asked for their advice, and it was a bad advice, still you should continue consulting with them. Isn't that what democracy is all about? Well, in a democracy, it doesn't mean that you will always make the right decision, but it will always be a decision that people have a vested interest in implementing. And when they have a vested interest, well, they're not going to grumble. They're not going to blame politicians for those mistakes. They will blame themselves. That's why, by the way, democracies are far more stable systems than dictatorships. You see, in dictatorships, we don't have a system of counseling, right? One person makes a decision. If it's a bad decision, well, everybody will point to him as the culprit. But when everybody participates in the decision-making process, they need to look no further than the mirror to see who was the culprit, right? That's why they're not going to plant bombs, they're not going to assassinate politicians, because they know that they were the guy who sent the guy to Washington. Okay, the verse basically reaffirmed the principle of consultation. Now, let's become a little bit more philosophical. In effect, consultation is really about putting collective reason above individual reason. That's what it means. Putting collective reason, collective judgment, over and above individual judgment and individual reason, even if that individual is the person of the prophet. So even though that individual may be the prophet, still, collective reason supersedes individual reason. Now, remember, when it comes to theological matters and revealing God's words, Islam grants the final say to the prophet. However, when it comes to public decision-making, Islam gives the authority to collective reason and consultation. And that is an Islamic principle. We also, in Islamic jurisprudence, we have a concept in Arabic we call ijma, or in English it means consensus. What does consensus mean in judicial systems? Simply put, this concept means that in order for a religious decree to be binding on all Muslims, a consensus must be built among the experts, among the scholars. If this consensus is achieved, then that decree is binding on all Muslims. So we have this concept also in Islamic jurisprudence. So consultation and consensus are two concepts endorsed by the Islamic tradition that honor collective reason. Guess what? Democracy is also based on collective reason. So on this principle as well, Islam is not only compatible with democracy, but I even want to go further by saying that democracy serves one of the important principles in the Islamic tradition, which is consultation and consensus building. I'm going to make two more points and then close the lecture. The fourth important principle that is served by democracy: consent of the people is a prerequisite for legitimacy of political authority. As I mentioned, in the early Islamic tradition, we had the concept of bay'at, which means consent, right? Even in the Prophet's era, Muslims had this concept, which required aspiring leaders to secure permission of the citizens before assuming political office. In a sense, this principle recognized the right of Muslim citizenry to choose their political leaders. So bay'at is quite similar to the notion of consent in political philosophy. Again, this notion of consent is shared between the Islamic tradition and democracy. So on that account, again, democracy is compatible with Islam. And the final point: justice is served by democracy in modern times. And let me explain a little bit about this, because it may not be very intuitive. You see, justice is the cornerstone of Islamic social model. In the Holy Quran, time and again, Muslims are instructed to be just in their personal as well as public life. The Quran even goes so far as saying that establishing justice was a primary reason for the coming of the messengers of God. In other words, God sent his prophets, his messengers, so that people will establish justice in the social order that they have. Now, the question that intellectual Muslims ask is the following: would dictatorship or democracy serve social justice better? Would it be just to take away the right of people to govern themselves? Would it be just to give voice only to a minority in making public decisions? So that is the main question. Let me make a quick point here. In eras not long ago, we didn't have public education, right? Only a minority of the people afforded to go to school. Only a minority could read and write. Only a minority could publish literal works. Therefore, under those circumstances, it was quite reasonable that the elite who had access to education, information, and knowledge would have a greater weight in public affairs, in the decision-making process. So it was quite reasonable to give those folks greater weight. The circumstances of life in those days necessitated that such a decision-making structure be in place. We had that structure in place in Europe. We had it also in the Islamic Empire. Now, in Islamic literature, we often come across the concept of the assembly of experts. The assembly of experts, in Farsi we call that Majlis-e Khebregan, right? Assembly of experts. That was an institution in the Islamic civilization where the learned, the experts, and the scholars would gather, exchange opinions, vote amongst themselves, and make public decisions. Now, that institution, again, was not an Islamic institution. It was a civic institution. It was an institution that was necessitated by the objective realities of the time. In modern era, obviously, things have dramatically changed. Now we have public education. And public also enjoys wide access to information. The elite do not have monopoly over those types of access anymore. Today, even we have, thanks to the expansion of media, we have free flow of information, free flow of news, political analysis, and so forth. And every one of us, by having access to the internet at least, we can have all kind of information at our fingertips. Now, under modern circumstances, according to Muslim intellectuals, if we restrict the public's right in political deliberations and decision-making process, in effect, we have turned our back to collective reason. We have deprived our communities from fully utilizing the brain powers of all the citizens. This act would betray Islam's emphasis on justice as the overarching principle of social organization. So on this ground, on the ground of social justice, democracy serves the important Islamic concern as well. Muslim intellectuals have more reasons to embrace democracy, and since I've talked way over time, I'm going to stop right here, and hopefully you got some understanding of the case that these Muslims make for embracing democracy in modern times. So as far as they are concerned, Muslims can and should embrace parliamentary democracy and republicanism as the appropriate system of government for this era. Thank you very much for your attention, and God bless you all. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.